My name is Melvin Shipp. I have the pleasure of being the moderator for this afternoon's session. And to remind you, this session is entitled Achieving Health Equity Solutions from the Field. We are delighted and pleased to have with us some remarkable individuals with respect to expertise in this area who will be sharing their points of views, their experiences and perspectives. We want to make sure that we stay tightly with the timelines because probably the most interesting part of this entire session will be the questions that I'm sure you will have or the discussions that you will have after their presentations. So without further ado, I will get on with making the introduction so that we can begin. Our first speaker this afternoon is Barbara Ferrer. As her city's health commissioner, Dr. Ferrer manages a $154 million budget and oversees 12,000 employees. In addition to operating public health programs, the commission provides oversight of Boston's emergency medical services, several substance abuse treatment facilities, and the second largest homeless service program in New England. A high school principal in the public, that's remarkable, I hadn't realized that. In Boston's public schools from 2004-2007, Dr. Ferrer returned to the commission in 2007 after having previously served as deputy director for 6 years. During that time, she spearheaded a broad-based and comprehensive campaign to reduce racial and ethnic health disparities. Barbara Ferrer has more than 25 years of experience working in healthcare. Prior to joining the Boston Public Health Commission, she spent 5 years in the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, first as Director of Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Prevention, and later as Director of the Division of Maternal and Child Health. In 1988, she received a master's degree in public health from Boston University and was rewarded a Pew Foundation doctoral fellowship to attend Brandeis University. She wrote her doctoral thesis on a hospital length of stay determinants for AIDS patients and in 1994 received her doctorate from Brandeis University's Heller School for Advanced Studies in Social Welfare. Dr. Ferrer also holds a master's degree in education from the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Without further ado, Dr. Ferrer.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. Shipp, and thank you, everyone, for being here. It's a pleasure and an honor to do a presentation. I'm going to talk a little bit. I'm going to actually talk very specifically about what we're doing in Boston and particularly how we're organizing ourselves as a local health department to work on a health equity agenda. And I'm going to go pretty quickly through the first part, which is just some data to set the context about what the issues are in Boston that we face. And I don't think they're dissimilar to issues that many of you face in your own communities. But if you look at routinely collected health data in the city of Boston and you compare our black residents to our white residents, you see a pattern of stark differences. And with the exception of four areas, and in those areas there are very slight differences, black residents will do much worse than our white residents. The differences are somewhere between 1.5 times more severe illness and death to 27 times for homicides related to gun violence. Unfortunately, it starts at birth, where black babies have been dying at rates that are 1.5 to 4 times greater than white babies for as long as we've been collecting data. The death rate for black babies in 2008 in the city of Boston was higher than the death rate was for white babies 25 years ago. Now, remember, Boston has near universal coverage for health care. Before we had health care reform, we also had free care at all of our hospitals and our 25 community health centers. So we didn't have an access issue. We're also home to some of the most premier training facilities for clinicians in the world, and we're a well-resourced city. And not surprising, at the end of life, black residents have the lowest life expectancy when compared to all other residents in the city of Boston. And we're a city that still has a significant amount of residential segregation. If you look at this slide, the slide all the way over to your left is the percent of the population that's characterized as black in our given neighborhoods. We're a city of neighborhoods. And you'll see that, sort of the heart and soul of Boston are people of color. And they live primarily in three neighborhoods, Dorchester, Roxbury, and Mattapan. And that most of our neighborhoods are either predominantly white or they're predominantly neighborhoods of color. In those neighborhoods where our residents of color live, you again see much worse outcomes. That's where you see the highest rates of foreclosures, elevated lead levels, heart disease hospitalizations and asthma hospitalizations at much higher rates than you see anywhere else in the city. So again, black residents at worse health and the neighborhoods in which they live also have the worst health outcomes. The same thing for homicides. The highest rates are in Roxbury, Dorchester, and Mattapan. Obesity, huge problem. 35% of our residents in Mattapan are obese. Another 33% are overweight. Almost 70% of residents in that neighborhood who are black are, in fact, either overweight or obese. And then if you look at assets in the city, you know, we're very fortunate. We have a lot of parks, a lot of green space, and that tends to be fairly well distributed, but other things are not as well distributed. So, for example, bike paths. We have a lot of bike paths. They're concentrated in the area sort of over at one corner of the city. And if you remember back from when we looked at what neighborhoods those are neighborhoods that are downtown neighborhoods, and they're predominantly made up of white residents. And, you know, when we look at, you know, what may be causing inequities in health, we, as many of you, have spent a lot of time trying to understand the role that social determinants play. And we've come to accept, based on the evidence starting with the Institute of Medicine report back 10 years ago, to the mounting scientific evidence that's been in the journals lately, that really social determinants of health, as you heard earlier today, play an enormous role in determining people's health outcomes. We would add to the list of things that are frequently talked about racism as being, for us, one of the most determining factors in people's health outcomes. Racism has an independent impact on people's health status in terms of the discrimination, the bias, the lack of opportunity that people face because of racism, but it also has an impact on pretty much every other social determinant of health, including people's access to education and jobs, healthy environments where they live, and, as we saw in the ILN report, what happens when they try to access health services. So in Boston, and this is where I really want to focus my conversation today, in Boston, you know, back 8 years ago, the mayor convened a task force with business leaders, religious leaders, healthcare leaders, residents, and really developed a blueprint for what the city needed to do to rid itself of inequities in health outcomes, you know, making a firm commitment from the mayor's office that this was the most challenging problem we faced, but this was the most important issue to come together on. And so we've done a fair amount of work across the city, and I'm not going to be able to describe all that we did across the city, but what I want to focus on is what does that mean for a health department? Because I think, you know, oftentimes when we think about social determinants of health, many of us are overwhelmed by the idea that our jobs now are to somehow fix the social conditions under which people live. And while I'm going to say, you know, we alone can't fix much of anything, it is our job to acknowledge that the reality is that it is those very conditions that are going to affect people's health status, and then line ourselves up as institutions to really put our work in places where we're going to make a difference on those social conditions. And that's what I want to talk about. So how do we do that? You know, we're a large health department. We have about 1,200 people, not 12,000. Sorry. I was like, 12,000. The whole city of Boston. Okay. But we have a large, you know, we have a large workforce, and we have a lot of money. We have a budget of $155 million. So, you know, I'm not going to say the work can't be done. But what we did have to do was think about what the core strategies would be for us, and then what would be our guiding principles. So, you know, we are very focused on evidence. And I think being data-driven also helps you with the efficiency arguments. Let's not keep doing things just because we've always been doing them. That's, you know, sort of one of the biggest obstacles. We run a great home visiting program because we've run it for 20 years. We need to look at the data. Does the home visiting program really reduce infant mortality rates amongst black women? And if it doesn't, what else should we be doing? So data information is critical, and sharing that information and creating a communication loop with residents, with other providers, with other community-based organizations is also essential for us. Community investment, we believe very strongly that as a health department, the best thing we can do to build healthy communities is invest in communities, and that means investing in the residents in those communities in terms of training opportunities, but it also means investing in the community-based organizations that are in those communities. And we need to do policy and practice change, and I'll talk a little bit about what that can look like in a health department. You could see we have some guiding principles. We're explicit about being committed to racial justice. We're explicit about understanding that this means we would be looking for social change, and we want to be accountable to the community and to our residents, and make sure that people can judge us by our performance. Like, we don't want to hide away and say, job's too difficult, we're not really sure, this didn't happen, it's not really our fault. And we want to have integrity, and mostly throughout all of this, we want to be collaborating with each other in the department, but also with all of our partners. So we developed an institutional framework that said, you know, one of the things we have to do is become competent ourselves in doing racial and social justice work. We need to support and build the community's capacity to lead some of these efforts, and we need to figure out where we should be in partnerships with others who really control a lot of the resources that are going to affect people's health outcomes. So to build institutional capacity, we have three areas where we're focused. A big one is on providing employees with education and training opportunities. I'm going to talk about what that looks like. Every single program at the commission has to have a logic model or be developing a logic model that includes in it how that program is going to contribute to efforts to eliminate health inequity. So you have to be explicit about what you're going to be able to do that's going to fit into a model that actually does work to eliminate health inequities. Whether you're at EMS, Emergency Medical Services, you're in our shelters, because we run a lot of shelters, you're working in substance abuse, you're running a TB clinic, it all has to tie into the overarching work of eliminating health inequities. And I'm going to talk about what we did to make that explicit. And then we have an internal working group, and actually Pam Jones is here, who works in this, she's Director of Policy and Planning, and she's really headed up that effort to create an anti-racism working group that actually looks at all of our policies, the way we operate as an agency, and tries to make sure that we are, in fact, looking very carefully about what we're doing as an institution to become an anti-racist organization. So we're very explicit about that, and we have a fairly large group of folks that invest a lot of time into helping us figure out what that work would look like and what we need to do. So we have one of the ways that we made it explicit for everybody is we have three overarching goals, and these are all equity goals, and they're explicit and they're public. And so we're looking at issues around low birth weight, chlamydia, and obesity. But what we're looking at is not just improving the rates, but actually these are areas where we need to narrow the gap. And we've actually set a five-year target, and we've put it out publicly. So judge us by whether or not we meet our goals. If we say we're interested in promoting a health equity agenda, it only makes sense that then we actually do something to narrow the gap. And so we've actually put out there, we need to do this. We've also told every single program, you need to have an action plan that helps us tie into this. And we've done some training around that. So we have a commission-wide action plan that every single program has helped us build that shows what the efforts are going to be that are going to help us accomplish and reach these three goals as a city. We have to go along with that so that we can all do this work. Most of us didn't come into public health thinking that we were going to be community organizers or facilitating community meetings or paying attention to a health equity agenda. I have the most wonderful staff, but I'm going to be honest, they went in to do good things and to be kind people and to be compassionate. They work at our shelters. They work in treatment facilities. They work with the most vulnerable people in the city. But they didn't necessarily come in thinking they were going to work around racial and social justice. And so we have a 22-hour mandatory training for every single employee. 14 hours of the training are a two-day training that really is around how to use a social and racial justice framework to do your work at the health department. And we've put almost half of our workforce, more than half of our workforce, has actually gone through the training at this point, and it's received really high marks. I mean, people have enjoyed it and felt like they learned something. The next, then people get to select from some skill building workshops that are very specific. You know, how do you facilitate a community meeting? How do you make your budget line up with a health equity agenda? How do you do policy, make policy change? So very explicit skill building sessions. And through this we've said, you know, we're all in this together, we're all learning together, and we're all learning from each other. And that's very different for us. I mean, we've never really had a professional development angle at the commission for everybody. You know, people, the nurses got some things, physicians were getting some things, social workers were getting some things, but everybody wasn't getting the same, and everybody wasn't getting something. In terms of building community capacity, we really have put a fair amount of money back out into the community, and it isn't being used to deliver clinical services, which obviously we have other money that is being used for that. But we've really tried to target areas, some that are more traditional around public health work and some that are not. So we're doing, for example, a lot around youth leadership development and have funded youth organizations throughout the city. Some of that is with Kellogg money. We've done some racial healing work. Some of it was with city dollars as well. We've done a lot of workforce development work, pipeline. We have a huge investment in pipeline programs for high school students, for example, trying to get them in summer and after school programs that we run to be able to be academically ready to go to college and pursue health careers. And, you know, we've also done some work around violence prevention that I'm going to talk about in a second. So the violence prevention work, here's an example of us doing things differently. We actually are working in five neighborhoods with the highest rates of community violence. And what we've done in those neighborhoods is we've funded community-based organizations in each neighborhood with a community organizing strategy. So they hire a community organizer and what we call block captains that receive you know, small amounts of money to organize on their block. They're responsible for doing resident engagement, for connecting those residents to social services and supports, particularly summer jobs for kids and after-school programming for kids, and to make improvements in the built environment. And we have an agreement with the city departments to meet regularly with, you know, they have resident committees to make to fix the problems that get identified, be they traffic lights or abandoned lots or broken down buildings or noise, you know, excessive noise or playgrounds that aren't being cleaned up. So it's been very successful because there's immediate gains in cleaning up the built environment, but there's also, it's really based on engaging residents who live there to come up with their own plan for building a culture of peace. And the same thing around, you know, sort of the obesity issues. We really focused a lot on changing the built environment. We helped fund a greenhouse, a year-round greenhouse that both employs people. It has an enterprise zone, so it pays for itself now. Grows a lot of tomatoes. I forget, like 75,000 tons of tomatoes a year. But it's also a learning opportunity for the residents. We funded 400 backyard gardens, and those were built by youth that were trained over the summer to go work with families. So those are sustainable. Those families have those gardens forever. And we've increased by over 200 plots community gardens. We also did some work in two of our neighborhoods on corner stores, trying to, you know, really work with the small businesses on offering healthier options. And we have a huge citywide effort around walking groups, particularly walking groups that can use our parks, because we have hundreds of parks and they're underutilized. So this is a way of really having safety in the parks and having them better used, but also getting people out with their neighbors to walk. I think one of the places where we've had you know, sort of the biggest change is our ability to do more work around policy. And some of that has been, you know, working on things like national gun laws. Others have been on things, great, things in the city like quarry reform, which, you know, we got some legislation. We are one of the lead agencies. People say, what are you doing around criminal offender records, which is what that is. And we're saying, you know, people can't be healthy if they don't have jobs. And when they come out of prison, they've done their time. They need to be able to work. So, you know, so we really entered into areas where we traditionally were not necessarily active, but it made a big difference for the first time we quarry reform legislation did pass last year. We've also been really strong advocates around paid sick leave. You know, that came up with H1N1, I'm sure for many of you as well. all people were sick, they couldn't take time off from work. It was horrible because they weren't getting paid. And we also have worked really hard with our other city departments, and I'm going to give a couple examples about how important it is to reach out to the transportation department because they got a lot of money, and schools and public works and the police department. And we also have a board of health, so we have a lot of regulatory authority, and we've done a lot around tobacco, around trans fats. And I'm going to give some examples. Sugar-sweetened beverages, the mayor issued an executive order. No municipal buildings or property can sell any sugary beverages anymore, and that's been huge. So we can, in fact, change the landscape. And I'm going to give a really concrete example. We had about 90 storage lots, junkyards, and transfer stations. And as you can see, the blue line is where we were in 1999. We had about 90 facilities in the city of Boston. And they were heavily concentrated in Dorchester and in Roxbury. Our board looked at this and tried to figure out, you know, how they could actually make an impact. And they passed a regulation that required all of these places to be inspected and to be permitted. And I want to say, if you look at 2011, we only have 12 facilities left because they couldn't pass the inspections. And so they couldn't get permitted. And although we still have some inequity, you know, like I think 33% are in those two neighborhoods, it is much, much reduced. It was at 85% before. So, you know, here's a way where a Board of Health can act and, in fact, you know, make a huge difference in the outcomes for the people who live. These are residential areas. People live right next door to these facilities. We also have health in all policies with the city. So I'm going to come talk in a minute about the Boston Housing Authority, but our Boston Housing Authority and all of its developments will go smoke-free as of September of this year. So there'll be no smoking allowed in any of the indoor apartment complexes. We partner with transportation, neighborhood development, and public works on some active transit. So we now have bike paths almost everywhere, disproportionately, again, in the downtown area, but working to get those bike paths out to the neighborhoods. And we have a team of folks from multiple agencies who have been trained on health impact assessments and will be using that tool as new development projects come online. And, you know, we've developed a tool with them that really looks at the health equity issues. First time ever in our city that people will be looking at that. The most impressive example I can give, and I'm going to really close with this, about the importance of public health work is on this slide. So one of the things we did is we had a sense that people in the housing developments had the highest rates of asthma. We added a question to the BRFSS. This is self-report data. And as you can see, we were right. Adults had almost twice the rate of reported asthma. If they lived in a development, that's the blue line compared to people who didn't live in any subsidized housing. We went in with an individually oriented intervention called Breathe Easy at Home, where we go into houses and we look for the triggers, very quickly realized that there was a huge problem with pest infestation, and what was happening is people were not only subject to the problems of the pests, but they were using very dangerous pesticides, and so that was a double trigger for asthma. We worked with the developments over the next 4 years on integrated pest management, and in 2010, the rate of adult asthma in the housing developments dropped by almost half, and there was really no significant decline in the rate of asthma in the non-subsidized adult population. There is no clinical intervention. I wish Don Berwick was here. There is no clinical intervention that lowers asthma rates like this. So again, you know, I think this is really important where public health goes in, has really good interventions, but also then understands what the policy issues are and is able to work with other departments to make policy change. So we leave this list for folks to think about asking yourselves different questions when you're trying to organize your work. It's not how we can promote healthy behavior. It's how do we target dangerous conditions and reorganize land use policies and transportation policies. It's not how to reduce disparities in the distribution of illness. It's how to eliminate inequities in the distribution of resources and power. It's not what social programs and services are needed. It's what kind of social change is needed to really make lasting change. It's not how can individuals protect themselves against health disparities. It's what kind of community organizing and alliance building and partnerships do we need to create that would actually protect our communities. So we think you need to work upstream and to refocus activities. And policies that are good for health are not always what we just traditionally call health policies. We should be working on community health, and we should be building strategic partnerships. So thank you very much.